Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Marty Johnson reporting. The United Nations Security Council has unanimously endorsed a proposed roadmap for peace in Syria. Foreign ministers adopted the U.S.-drafted resolution late Friday after a day-long meeting of the International Syria Support Group in New York. The resolution expresses support for a Syrian-led political process facilitated by the UN. The American airstrike that may have killed a number of Iraqi soldiers Friday seems to have been a mistake that involved both sides, said U.S. Defense Secretary Ash Carter today. He called Iraqi Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi to express condolences and spoke with reporters during his visit to the Gulf.
I explained to him our regrets, and he and I agreed that this was an event that we both regretted, and that there would be an investigation of it, but that these kinds of things happen when you're fighting side by side, as we are, and we recommitted ourselves to that campaign against ISIL.
The Pentagon chief did not provide further details about the strike. Police in the Somali capital of Mogadishu say several people are dead after a car bomb exploded there on a busy street today. Witnesses say the explosion was accompanied by gunfire and the casualties are believed to be civilians. Reuters News Service reports part of a market was destroyed in the blast. On Wednesday, national and regional leaders agreed to end 3 days of talks on how to hold elections in 2016. The leaders decided to dissolve the government next September, but are not prohibiting President Hassan Sheikh Mahmoud and 275 members of parliament from seeking re-election. This is VOA News. President Obama has outlined his plans for his final full year in office. At a year-end news conference, Mr. Obama stressed the need for the U.S. to remain vigilant, even as his administration works with the international community to root out the Islamic State militants.
Now, squeezing ISIL's heart, its core in Syria and Iraq, will make it harder for them to pump their terror and propaganda to the rest of the world. At the same time, as we know from San Bernardino, we have to remain vigilant here at home.
Mr. Obama touted big wins for his administration, among them diplomacy with Iran and Cuba, passage of the significant climate and Asia-Pacific trade deals, and the Supreme Court ruling legalizing gay marriage. China is accusing the U.S. of conducting a serious military provocation, flying B-52 planes over Chinese man-made islands earlier this month in the South China Sea. China's defense ministry said in a statement today it warned the aircraft to leave, and that the U.S. action is leading to militarizing conditions between the two nations. China, which claims almost the entire South China Sea, has stepped up a program of land reclamation and construction in the disputed islands and reefs, which sparked concern in the U.S. as well as other nations around the Asia-Pacific region. Meantime, Chinese internet giant Alibaba announced earlier this month that it is buying Hong Kong's premier English-language newspaper, which has a reputation for deep reporting on subjects that mainland Chinese outlets avoid. More from Shannon Vincent in Hong Kong.
Alibaba said it is buying the media assets of the SCMP Group. That includes Hong Kong's most influential English-language newspaper, the South China Morning Post. In Hong Kong's media industry, the purchase has raised concerns over the potential of increased censorship of the newspaper and throughout Hong Kong media. Oi Wen Lam is the co-founder of nmediahk.net, a Chinese-language news website that covers Hong Kong.
Now that Alibaba has purchased SMP, it will certainly add to the worries or fears of the locals, Hong Kong people, about the change of the paper's nature.
Jack Ma, Alibaba's executive chairman, promised he will not censor coverage and would preserve the paper's editorial independence. Shannon Van Sant for VOA News, Hong Kong.
The head of Rwanda's Electoral Commission says partial results show Rwandans may have voted to change the constitution, allowing President Paul Kagame to run for office several more times. And Iran has taken delivery of 14 pieces of American art purchased nearly 40 years ago but blocked for export due to a break in bilateral relations after the 1979 Islamic Revolution. State-run English-language channel Press TV says the artworks were purchased in 1978. Diplomatic ties severed in 1979. I'm Marty Johnson in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington.
There are many constitutionals approved at a tune of 98.4%. But that means 98.4% of Rwandans have voted yes.
Rwandans vote in a referendum to let President Paul Kagame to extend his rule.
We do believe they should send troops maybe in Rwanda rather than sending them in Burundi, because there are reports saying that in Rwanda people are being trained.
The Burundian government rejects the African Union's proposal to send peacekeepers to the country.
Mehdi says increasing the price of petrol to us, the Borobada, is a loss.
And a sharp fuel price hike in South Sudan sparks a nationwide outcry from motorists. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Provisional results released Saturday by the Rwandan National Electoral Commission on the referendum show overwhelming approval to amend the constitution. The measure paves way for President Paul Kagame to seek another term. Rwandans in the diaspora voted on Thursday, while the entire country voted on Friday. Charles Munyeza, the executive secretary of the National Electoral Commission, told me that voter turnout was high, with 98.3% of registered voters participating in the polling.
Rwandans have been holding a referendum on the amendment of the new constitution. And we had polls in the diaspora on Saturday the 17th for Rwandans living outside Rwanda. Then on the 18th, that was Friday, we had the general elections in Rwanda. The general process was smooth. We had a very large voter turnout of 98.3% of registered voters. And the provision is that we've just really show that there are many constitutionals approved at a tune of 98.4%. But that means 98.4% of Rwandans have voted yes in terms of the amendment of the constitution, and 1.6% voted no in terms of not approving the amended constitution. So in terms of figures, we've got 6,155,606 Rwandans voted yes, and 100,863 Rwandans voting no. So the process has been peaceful. The atmosphere was very peaceful at the polling stations. Rwandans were very enthusiastic. I think this is the first time we have got that kind of voter turnout. And we are impressed that the youth, mostly the youth, the students, really participated in their big numbers.
The opposition says that there was no campaign allowed and the time was too short for them to carry their message through. How do you address such a concern?
People have been raising that concern, but have been reminding those people making those concerns that this is an issue that came from the population. As you are aware, over 4 million Rwandans had petitioned parliament requesting for the amendment of the constitution. So for them, they were just looking at one article, but the amendment touched many, many articles of the constitution. So if 4 million out of 6.3 million Rwandans eligible to vote had requested for this amendment, then it means Rwandans knew what was taking place. There wasn't much need for a month or 2 months of campaign, but whatever time was there, everybody had time to canvass for a yes or no vote. And as far as I know, some opposition political party did it in the media. And we think time was enough for people to make their choices. And You know that even in these other countries, we know countries where the surrender has been called in only 1 week, and people have turned up in those referenda. So I think it's not very peculiar to Rwanda.
Now that the voting is complete, the outcome has been released and announced to the people of Rwanda. What is next for the Electoral Commission in this regard?
We've just released provisional election results. Not later than Monday, not later than 21st of this month, we shall announce what we call final results. And based on that, we are going to make our final report, official report, to competent authorities. And again, the constitutional amendment process will continue, because there are other steps that we need to be done by other competent authorities to gazette this new constitution as amended.
Charles Munyaneza is the Executive Secretary of the National Electoral Commission of Rwanda. He spoke with me from the capital, Kigali. For a reaction regarding the Rwandan referendum to extend Mr. Kagame's rule, we are joined live via telephone link from Maryland by Dr. Theogene Rudasingwa, a former Secretary General of the ruling Rwandese Patriotic Front and a former Rwandan ambassador to the United States. Good afternoon, Dr. Rudasingwa.
Good afternoon.
Well, let me ask you this. What was your reaction after hearing the provisional result of this referendum, and especially after hearing from Charles Munyaneza?
Well, to be honest, this is probably one of the saddest moments in the recent history of Rwanda, because Rwanda is never without drama, but this is very dramatic in a sense that considering what has happened to Rwanda, I will not have imagine that the ruling regime would go to this extent of manipulating the population simply to continue its power, its hold on to power, change the constitution, and without really considering that there are very serious consequences to this outcome.
But why do you say the government is manipulating the people? Because approximately 4 million people petitioned parliament to amend the constitution. The president himself and his government have said that the people willingly decided, because of his good leadership and because of what they are enjoying currently, it's all about free will. Why do you doubt that?
Yeah, because anybody who is very familiar with the story of Rwanda, both the pre-colonial one, the post-colonial one, but especially the recent story of Rwanda, is that there is a tendency for those in power, and especially those who rule by dictatorial means, to manipulate the population of Rwanda, because even before the advent of the Rwandese Patriotic Front, before we came into power, Rwanda was governed thus, and therefore the population that is easily coerced by all sorts of means, especially through electoral means, before Kagame came to power, the president was elected, President Habyarimana was elected 99%. And ever since President Kagame came to power, he has always been elected 95% and above. And the referendum simply gives that kind of outcome, 98%. So on the surface, when you have a society that does not have all these fundamental freedoms of free association, the participation of political parties, free civil society, and a free media, then it becomes very easy to coerce the population into that whole idea of the population demanding that there should be a change in the constitution, or even saying that the referendum has returned a yes to the tune of 98%. So on the surface, it may look to a stranger that actually this is a spontaneous and overwhelming statement on the part of the population that, yes, they want this sort of affairs, but there's no freedom of speech in Rwanda, no freedom of association. So you can only say this is a very highly manipulated process, and the regime is extremely efficient in returning these types of results.
Dr. Rudasingwa, until recently, you were a prominent member of the ruling Rwandese Patriotic Front. Now, you came to power espousing certain ideals and among other things. Is this what you fought for?
This when I said, and I'm saying this from my heart, that when I said this is one of the saddest moments of the recent story of Rwanda, dramatic story of Rwanda, is that if you read very carefully, even today in the DRPF kind of agenda, way back then, what we fought for, the rationale of the RPF struggle was a fundamental change in Rwanda, change the way we govern ourselves, the question of succession, especially that we would like to have peaceful and democratic succession in the country. And 20 years later, these hopes have been dashed, and there remains one person in the ring, and that person is President Kagame and a few people who support him. And that makes it really very sad, in the sense that for those who died, including those who died in genocide and thereafter, that their blood has been in vain because the entire revolution has been taken off course.
Thank you very much. Dr. Theogene Rudasingwa is a former Secretary General of the ruling Rwandese Patriotic Front and a former Rwandan ambassador to the United States. The African Union will be violating Burundi's sovereignty if the continental body goes ahead with plans to send about 5,000 peacekeeping troops to the country to protect civilians. Presidential advisor Willie Nyamitwe says the country's security agencies are capable of maintaining peace and protecting civilians. The AU's Peace and Security Council approved sending the peacekeepers to Burundi at its Thursday meeting to review the current situation in the Central African country. But Nyamitwe told me that the Burundian government will not accept any international troops.
First of all, Burundi is a sovereign country, and they cannot decide to send troops in Burundi without the commitment of Burundi. Another thing to know is that it's not yet a decision to send troops in Burundi, not yet a decision from the African Union, because the head of state have to decide, not only the Peace and Security Council. But we have a similar problem to when thinking about this decision, and we don't even understand how people can think sending 5,000 persons troops in Burundi when in DRC they've sent 3,000 to kick out the M23. But we do believe they should send troops maybe in Rwanda rather than sending them in Burundi, because there are reports saying that in Rwanda, people are being trained in order to come to disturb the peace in Burundi. So they have to send troops there, not to send them in Burundi, where we are at peace.
Mr. Willie Nyamitwe, are you therefore saying that the African Union will be violating Burundi's sovereignty if indeed it goes ahead with its proposal to send troops to Burundi?
Yes, of course. And this is not thinking in our mind. We cannot understand how those people can think they can send troops in Burundi when in Burundi, people who are in Burundi are living at peace. Yes, we do understand that there are some people who are trying to destabilize the country, but there are a few, and the Burundi security forces are able to secure the country and to protect the civilians. So we cannot understand how people can think to send by force troops in Burundi. And I think this will never, never happen in our country.
Critics of the government are saying that the government is to blame for the insecurity in the country, and that President Pierre Nkurunziza has been unable so far to stabilize the situation. And that is why a lot of international organizations are calling and warning that if care is not taken, Burundi could be plunged into genocide.
Those to blame are all the people who tried to install the security situation in our country. Those to blame are the coup plotters. Those to blame are all the attackers who are coming to destabilize the peace in our country. Those to blame are the countries who are hosting all the coup plotters who ran away, Rwanda, Belgium, and some other countries. So we cannot blame Burundi for respecting its own laws. This is not fair.
People are saying that Burundi appears to be on the precipice of a genocide or civil war. And that is why the African Union had to take the unprecedented step by proposing a standby force to come and help stabilize the situation.
Those who are bringing in this theory of genocide is only in their mind. There's no genocide in Burundi, and it's impossible in Burundi to get or to cope with a genocide. We have been trying to emphasize that in Burundi, never and never again, we would not have a war or fightings between ethnic groups. Those who attacked the army barracks, for example, last week, they've been fought by the army and the police all together. But we find in the army and the police, all ethnic groups, Hutus and Tutsis, they are there. So who can say that there is any threat of genocide in Burundi? Those persons who are trying to emphasize this or to bring in this negative narrative, they are only enemies of Burundi. And maybe they try to install a genocide situation in their country, but they will never see it because Burundians are all committed to strengthen their peace and build their country in a peaceful way.
Willy Nyamitwe is a special advisor to Burundian President Pierre Nkurunziza. He spoke with me from the capital, Bujumbura. There's a fuel price hike in South Sudan. The government-owned Nile Petroleum Company announced new price for a liter of petrol. This sparked a nationwide outcry from motorists and commuters who must now pay more to travel around the capital, Juba, and to neighboring countries. It now costs 22 South Sudanese pounds a liter, up from 6 pounds. For VOA reporter Philip Thong Aleo spoke to commercial motorists in Juba who say they have no choices but to raise their prices.
A cyclist starts his motorbike engine to pick up a passenger who signaled for a ride at a bodaboda stop. Bodaboda is one of the most affordable means of transportation in the eastern states of South Sudan. Bodaboda driver Michael Nimeri is sitting on his motorbike at a roadside in the hot Juba sun, waiting for a passenger. Nimeri says he has had only 4 passengers today. Speaking in Arabic, he says the decision to triple the price of 1 liter of petrol has affected his business, which is his sole source of income.
زيادة بتاعت بترول طبعا لنا مع البودا اللي بيعصر شديد معنا وإنكم ما كان طبعا ضعيف.
Nimeri says increasing the price of petrol to us, the bodaboda, is a loss. He says their income is very low. Sometimes, he says, you can get 50 pounds a day and you have to buy a liter of petrol from the black market at 80 pounds. He says if the government could have only increased it to 14 pounds, it would be better because they have children to take care of. Nimeri is one of hundreds of South Sudanese who rely on bodaboda for monthly income. The state-owned Nile Petroleum Company released a statement on Saturday increasing the liter of fuel. A liter of fuel will now be supplied to gas stations at 20 pounds and sold at a wholesale price for 21 pounds per liter. Motorists will pay 22 pounds to get 1 liter of petrol at Bairio's petrol stations, an increase of 18 pounds from 6 pounds at the retail level. Nilepaid says the change was sparked by the central bank. Earlier this week, the Central Bank of South Sudan decided to adopt the black market exchange rate of the dollar to the South Sudanese pound. Bodaboda rider Juma Isaac says the change comes at a wrong time.
Most of the people are traveling now. There's no money. Also, dollar increase, no fuel, and even they're suffering really, but we don't know what happened to the government. It's affecting the country, plus us, even the bodabodas.
Jeffrey Mwangi is the chairperson of Kenyan Bodaboda Association in Bor, Jonglei State. Mwangi says the increase in fuel prices is not only the problem facing bodaboda drivers across Jonglei State.
In the petrol station, they are not selling the fuel. Since yesterday, they have closed the petrol station, and now we are buying that fuel. I don't know the black market or what we can call it, what, which is very expensive, and we don't know how far until when they are going to sell out the fuel. Even if they sell it to us on that price of 24, it is okay, rather than how we are buying currently.
Mwangi says passengers will have to dig deeper into their pockets to get rides. But Dennis Kamis, a supervisor at Sunmo Fuel Station in Nyakron West, a suburb of Juba, says station managers are not hiding fuel. Kami says petrol stations depend on Nile feed for fuel supplies. Speaking in Arabic, he asks why had the price increased. Kami says everything is expensive. He says it is not a problem caused by fuel stations or whoever. It is a problem facing the country, he says. Kami says his station has been closed for the last 2 weeks because there is no fuel. South Sudan has been experiencing fuel shortage for several months. Authorities in Juba blame the fuel shortages on the two-year conflict and lack of foreign currencies in South Sudan. For VOA News, I am Philip Onaleo in Juba.
Human rights groups have called on the Ethiopian government to exercise restraint in the current crackdown on protesters. Human Rights Watch says police and military forces have fired on demonstrations, killing at least 75 protesters and wounding many others. The Ethiopian government, which has previously put the toll at 5 dead, accuses protesters of terrorizing the civilians. Gerisu Tufa is an Ethiopian human rights activist. My colleague Douglas Impuga reached him in Amsterdam, Netherlands, for an update on the situation.
The latest what I'm hearing is that the crackdown is continued in different form. The witch hunting is going on still. They are going to people's house. They search houses and they arrest people randomly, almost all over Oromia, especially in this the region where things are very tense. People are being killed yet, and things are as worse as they were over the last 3 weeks.
There's a report by Human Rights Watch today saying at least 75 people have been killed so far during these weeks of protests. Does that figure sound true to you?
According to my information, it's not true. I mean, the number is much more greater than the number which I have read on the Human Rights Watch report. I've got more than 90% have been killed, and several hundreds have been wounded over the 3 weeks. And still, we couldn't collect all the information. So when the information is sufficiently collected, I think the number will be very much greater. Actually, the number doesn't matter. Even one human being is. Number doesn't fully describe the loss of human beings. Yet the number will be very much greater than what Human Rights Watch has reported. And it is good that they come and reported this, but the number will be very much bigger.
Many rights groups and some countries have criticized Ethiopia's use of anti-terrorism legislation to stifle peaceful dissent. What's the concern in the country about this crackdown?
The country characterized this peaceful protest as an act of terrorism, and over the last 3 weeks, the people who have been participated in the protest were millions, and there is no state in the world which characterizes the protest of millions of people as an act of terrorism. Then it must be some kind of insanity. So they characterize it this way just to continue using excessive force to crush innocent people and to kill kids. Elders, so it is very serious. I have seen a lot of states, governments have made some statement, but very mild, and is not that much strong enough to enforce the government to restrain using this kind of excessive force. They are acting as if they are fighting some kind of external enemy which invaded the country, not the peaceful people who are demanding for their legitimate rights.
Many countries, including the United States and Britain and some other organizations, have called on the government to stop the crackdown. Do you think the government in Addis Ababa will relent to the pressure to stop the crackdown?
Most of the statements made by the government are very mild and some kind of diplomatic rituals which cannot that much impact on the government, so I don't think the government will react, will restrain to use the excessive force, so the situation will continue worsening, I think. I'm not hopeful that the government will restrain.
That was Gerisu Tufa, an Ethiopian human rights activist. He spoke with my colleague Douglas Impuga from Amsterdam. You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotter, in Washington. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent, then we'll have commentary by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University. And right now it's time for music from our African collection. Enjoy what we have for you today. So baby, anything I say.
Dangerous,
like
baby girl, you are dangerous. Everybody now. Oh my God, no. Tell me your mind, oh. Oh, no, 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 no. We want to make you mine, oh. Baby girl, oh. You come up me from mine, oh. Take me down to major. The way you handle that. Uku.
You must marry me. You gon' love me. You gon' kill me, baby. wenzangu na mimi ni bure tunajisumbua. Situko kama 20 mabuzi vingasti wengine anawaonga. Oh mapenzi nilifanya kama mtoto nilie vibaya mie siwezi malo nikuto niache niseme jina. Oh mapenzi nilifanya kama mtoto nilie vibaya sina mengi. Sijui tu nini kitu nani kashuma Islam
Mr. Flavor
if we remember baby.
That was music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. It's now time for commentary and analysis by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University here in Washington. Hello, Dr. Nyang.
Hello, Africa. It is always a pleasure for me
to share my reflections on U.S. policy towards Africa. I always pay close attention to African opinions on and attitudes towards the United States. This week, as Americans gear themselves up towards Christmas, many issues around the world are very much looked at by Americans as they look towards the new year and as they look at the relationship with the rest of the world. What is very interesting for President Obama as he moved towards the end of the year 2015 and looking towards 2016 for himself, his family, and the rest of the people in the United States. For the people of the United States, as they look at Africa, they can see how political development is taking place in many of them, because many of the African countries, since independence, have been playing with state building and nation building. Some of them have made progress in creating unity among their people, and the pressing issues of human development is the politics of the belly and the politics of the head. The politics of the belly is in the economy. The most effective decision of the United States for the whole world is the decision from a small number of American leaders who control the economy. So it is the economy, stupid. It is the economy, stupid. It's the economy, stupid, once again. Once the U.S. leadership decide to deal with the rate of exchange, it has reverberating effect all over the world, including Africa. If you want to understand one fundamental relationship between the United States and Africa today, is the activity of two financial institutions in the United States. The MoneyGram business transferring millions of dollars to Africans from the United States in terms of immigrants. And that's one of the reasons why the politics of the belly for Americans and the rest of the world is coming back to affect U.S. relationship within Africa. MoneyGram is one, Western Union is another, and there are many other agencies. So the rate of exchange from the United States has reverberating effect in Africa, because the African bankers, whether they are local or foreign, African policymakers who are passing laws in their own country are all affected by these American decisions. It has serious consequences for U.S. policy in dealing with other areas. Here again, the politics of the belly and the politics of the head in the United States through the rate of exchange affect African foreign policy. And they immediately take you back to the visit of the Pope to Central Africa. You are not only interested in the politics of the belly, you are also interested in justice. Because human beings cannot organize themselves without justice. It is not only the politics of the belly, it is the politics of the spirit. So as the Christian community moves towards Christmas and New Year, the rest of the world who are not Christians are very much part of this activity, because it affects their spirits as human beings as they grapple with life and death issues. That is one of the reasons why, as I look at U.S. policy towards Africa, you talk about immigrants, immigrants, immigrants. This is a very important issue going back to 1776 for these United States. America is a young civilization. And that's the way it is today. As I look at U.S. policy towards Africa and African opinions on and attitudes, all the Africans are affected by this rate of exchange. This is true for Mexicans who get remittances to Mexico, and all the Latinos who also benefit. And the politics of the belly, the politics of the head, and the human spirit will be restored. That's the way it is today.
Thank you very much, Dr. Nyang. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sali, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, and our engineer for today, John Dryden, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. I remember, as the elders say, if you think you are too small to make a difference, then you haven't spent a night with a mosquito. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Global climate change is a defining challenge of our time. By most estimates, if global temperatures rise more than 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels, the results may well be catastrophic and irreversible. For the first time since the 1992 Earth Summit in Rio de Janeiro, where governments agreed to work toward the stabilization of greenhouse gas concentrations in the atmosphere at a level that would prevent dangerous anthropogenic interference with the climate system, countries around the world have reached a universal, multilateral agreement to mitigate the causes of climate change. On December 12th, 195 countries adopted the Paris Agreement, which establishes a global framework to reduce global greenhouse gas emissions. For the first time ever, all participating countries will set their own targets toward progressively and verifiably reducing their greenhouse gas emissions and will submit to a rigorous, standardized process of review. The agreement sets a goal for parties that includes keeping the temperature rise well below 2 degrees Celsius over pre-industrial levels. In order to do so, the world will need to move toward a clean energy economy. In the words of President Barack Obama, we'll have a strong system of transparency, including periodic reviews and independent assessments, to help hold every country accountable for meeting its commitments. The agreement places a strong focus on mobilizing public and private climate finance to support developing countries, especially for the poorest and most vulnerable, which can least afford the expenses associated with climate change and are also the most adversely affected by it. That is why, as part of a global effort, developed countries agreed to continue to mobilize jointly $100 billion per year from public and private sources in the context of meaningful mitigation action and transparency until 2025, when a new target for all parties will be set from a floor of $100 billion. We have reached an agreement, said Secretary of State John Kerry, that will help the world prepare for the impacts of climate change that are already here, and also for those we know are now headed our way inevitably. And we have reached an agreement that, fully implemented, will help us transition to a global clean energy economy and ultimately prevent the worst, most devastating consequences of climate change from ever happening, he said. We've taken a critical step forward.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.